Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. It is June 13th, 2016. And as you know, our topics here at this show, they're broad, they're wide, but the common theme is for us, taking an unflinching look at the way things are and being curious enough to wonder if we could do them better. My goal is to be fully alive and connected with life, with the grand mystery of it all. It's why I engage in personal introspection, as difficult as that process is from time to time. Now, given all the violence, depression, obesity, addictions, and general unhappiness reported throughout the United States, perhaps a bit of self-examination is due at the cultural level as well. If we did that, what might we learn? What sorts of observations could we make that might indicate we could do better? And what sorts of things might we actually do to improve things? To talk with us today about that is the author of the new book, Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. That author, of course, is Sebastian Junger, the number one New York Times bestselling author of the books War, The Perfect Storm, Fire, and A Death in Belmont. Together with Tim Hetherington, he directed the Academy Award-nominated film Restrepo, which won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. I'm quite excited to have him on the show with us today. Sebastian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell our listeners about the premise for the book Tribe and why you wrote it.
When I was young, I had a sort of mentor and uncle figure named Ellis, who was half Lakota Sioux, half Apache, and he grew up, he was born literally on a wagon out west in the, during the Depression. And when I was young, he said to me that, white people along the frontier were constantly running off to join the Indians. And the Indians never ran off to join the white people, that the flow of humanity was towards the tribal. And I wondered about that. I thought about that my whole life, that even captives, people who had been captured along the frontier by the Indians, when given the chance to go home, often didn't want to. And many, many years later, I was with American soldiers in Afghanistan, and I noticed a kind of similar thing, that after a very, very rough deployment, the guys that I was with got back to Vicenza, Italy, with their base, and they had a good time for a while. And then something settled in, and a lot of them said that they didn't want to go back to America. They wanted to go, they actually wanted to return to the war. And it reminded me of what Ellis had said. And what is it about civilization, about modern society, that's really so deeply unappealing, even to people who are benefiting, who have benefited from its wealth and from its stability. And so my book, Tribe, is really about that. It's about our ancient human preference for community. And what happens when you lose that in modern society? What happens to mental health, to rates of PTSD, to social cohesion? Rampage shootings go up, just like the tragic one yesterday in Florida. A lot of things fall apart when community falls apart.
Well, absolutely. And what you're describing is, and when you say modern culture, obviously goes pretty far back if we're talking about people wanting to run off and be with the Indian tribes from 100, 200 years ago. Now, Sebastian, I love the topic of this new book, Tribe, because it's got great timing, coming at a time of deep divisions in the American political landscape. And because the topic of cultural introspection, like you're describing, it's a really difficult one to approach at any time in life. But you took your intimate experience with war to draw an especially stark contrast between life in a military unit and life at home, and found the home life wanting. So to continue on that theme, I find that contrast astonishing, that something could be missing at home to such a degree that some veterans report that they would actually prefer to take the risk of violent injury or even death in the presence of their old unit over returning to modern or what we might call normal society. The topic becomes difficult to evade when presented in that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind that if you put soldiers in a platoon, about 40, 50 men, at least the platoon I was with was all men, and you put them in a remote area in combat, or even not in combat. I mean, most of the military actually doesn't fight directly. But they're sleeping shoulder to shoulder on the ground or in their barracks, and they're eating meals together. They're doing everything together, and they're completely dependent on each other for their survival. That's our human evolution. I mean, that's what we evolved for. That's the kind of life that humans are adapted to. So when you put people in that environment, they respond incredibly well because in a kind of genetic sense, it's familiar. But, you know, it's not just restricted to soldiers. I mean, civilians also, the people in London after the Blitz reported that they missed the Blitz. I mean, think about that. 30,000 Londoners were killed by German bombs. Strangers were sleeping shoulder to shoulder in the subway platforms, digging people out of rubble. I mean, it was an awful, awful time. And yet people said that they missed it. And what they missed was the social solidarity, the sort of us versus them. Like, we can do this. I mean, one lady said, you know, we would have all gone down to the beaches with broken bottles to fight the Germans if we'd had to. And humans are wired. We've adapted to surviving in extremely tough circumstances. What we're actually not adapted to is doing, we're not adapted to stability and peacefulness in some ways. It allows us to pursue a kind of individualism that leaves us deeply unconnected to groups. And being part of a group is what makes people feel physically and emotionally safe. And when you lose that, although there's great benefits to individualism, obviously, but when you lose that, it makes people really quite vulnerable to all kinds of mental illness and sort of psychic disturbances.
Well, now relating that back to what you wrote about from, in particular, the combat experience, you wrote that after months of combat, during which you wrote, soldiers all but ignore differences of race, religion, and politics within their platoon, and that they would then return to the United States and find a society that is basically at war with itself. People speak with incredible contempt about, depending on their views, the rich, the poor, the educated, the foreign-born, the president, or the entire U.S. government. You continue, today's veterans often come home to find that although they're willing to die for their country, they're not sure how to live for it. Now, I found that really striking because certainly part of that's correct, that the U.S. society is fractured. It's hard to rally around because you have to pick sides first. But what you just said before is that this society is also, it's kind of bland. It's highly isolated and maybe, frankly, it's boring.
Yeah, and to keep in mind, you know, we evolved to live in a certain way, and it takes 25,000 years for the human species to change genetically in any significant way. So we're walking around this modern society in bodies and using minds that are adapted to, you know, basically Ice Age Europe. And I've been living in small mobile groups of hunter-gatherers. You have to keep that in mind. So when you look at modern society, it's, you know, it's quite clear the things that are going to stress people. And it's the, you know, everyone living by themselves in an apartment in a high rise. People not being dependent on those immediately around them for their physical and mental well-being. I found one study extraordinary that compared depression rates in North America to depression rates in Nigeria. And urban women in North America, the most affluent group in the study, had the highest rates of depression. And rural women in Nigeria, incredibly poor, messed up country, had the lowest rates of depression. And, you know, of course, there's great stresses to poverty and all that, but what you do get in a society like that is incredible cohesion at the community level. And apparently that more than makes up for the stress of poverty.
Now, what an important topic, because in our culture, in the U.S. culture, many other Western cultures, standard of living is equated with quality of life. As long as you have a higher standard of living, you're this rich woman living in Manhattan, you should have this higher quality of life. And certainly, having the ability to buy what you want and buy experiences can add to your life, but not necessarily, I guess. And there've been a lot of studies about that showing that happiness and stuff is not well correlated. In fact, it's anti-correlated after a point. What you're saying is that there are things missing from our way of life, which we often sell to ourselves as being the pinnacle standard. It's worth not only fighting for, but dying for. In fact, we're going to spread it to other countries. It's that good. You're coming home and saying, maybe not that good. What kind of reception are you getting with that message?
Well, you know, first of all, the Western society and the affluence that comes with it has generated incredible breakthroughs in medicine, in legal thinking, in technology. So it's an engine for amazing technological and artistic and intellectual creativity. We can't sell that short. But it's not without its downsides. As wealth goes up in a society, the suicide rate tends to go up. The depression rate tends to go up. Those are the costs of living in a modern society, statistically. I think we're sort of like, we've all been sort of acculturated into thinking that our society is the best one. And if you look around, there's sort of a lot of evidence for that. I mean, look at us. We're all driving cars. You know, we're not pulling our water out of a dirty well. You know, like, I mean, this is a thing that's good in a lot of basic human ways. We've come a long way. But also, I think there is really is a deep sort of discontent in society. And you can see it in large ways and small. I mean, there was one study that I cite in my book where they evaluate the happiness of lawyers. And they find that the more a lawyer gets paid, the less likely he or she is to report that they're happy. The more likely they are to be an alcoholic, to be depressed. Public defenders who are not well paid relatively and who are not high status in the legal world are way more likely to report being content in their life and are much less likely to be alcoholics. So again, there's this trade-off. You get very high-powered people who are doing incredible things at enormous psychological cost to themselves. But in our society, we sort of venerate that accomplishment, and we actually don't value psychological health. So we're exacerbating the problem.
Now, this is pretty interesting to me. This is topics that we talk about a lot at my site, which is about the ways in which the need for community is something that has been rediscovered, and people are reexamining it. But I think you're touching on something that goes just a touch deeper as well. I happen to know a gentleman who was out in the perfect storm. He was on a 104-foot dragger. He had spent a lot of his time as a fisherman out of Gloucester, and he talked about how that storm and his instinct for survival and the bonding that happened with the 8 other guys that he was on that boat with surpassed any other experience he'd had in life. And he'd been out and he'd certainly had plenty of harrowing moments on other times. But that storm was a defining moment. And he said there was something about really being tested, really being alive, really being part of a unit where it mattered what you did and what the other people did, that there was a liveliness to that that he hasn't experienced elsewhere in life. And so there is something to I'm wondering if you could speak to that part of you know, how we keep ourselves safe and I mean, heck, they put rubber mats under jungle gyms now so kids don't, you know, hurt themselves when they fall off. We've created a lot of safety, but there's something that's reported, I think, particularly in your work, that being at the edge of life has a liveliness to it that's kind of hard to match.
Yeah, I mean, again, we evolved in an environment that was not safe. We're adapted to that. So if you take any kind of threat away, something's not being utilized in our wiring. I mean, it's been argued that ADHD, attention deficit disorder, basically, is the perfect state of mind for young men to be in when they're hunting or at war. I mean, they're constantly shifting focus, constantly moving, capable of a great, great concentration, but with a kind of roving attention span, so that you're taking everything in. I mean, that's hunting, that's war. It doesn't work very well in the modern classroom, but of course we're not adapted to the modern classroom. And it's very interesting that boys who are way, way more likely in every society in the world to engage in hunting and war than girls are, that they're the ones with the highest reported rates of ADHD, and girls are not. So I mean, you can see our evolutionary past in every aspect of what we do. And again, you don't have to be a soldier. You don't have to be a fisherman on the high seas in the storm to experience that. I talked to a woman who had cancer, and she said her family, her people, her tribe, her community, whatever you want to call it, rallied around her and sort of supported her during this terrible time. And she got through it. She survived. She beat the odds. And she said, you know, it's really poignant. She said, now I miss being sick. She misses that community around her. So, you know, it's not a kind of thing. Well, I'm not talking about sort of macho soldiers who like who like war. You know, I mean, this is a far more profound problem that affects everybody.
Well, absolutely. I was down in living in North Carolina in the 80s, and in 1989, Hurricane Hugo came through, and I was in the Piedmont area. And we just had 4 inches of saturating rain the week before, so the ground was loose. Hugo comes ashore. You know, we're 3 hours from the coast there. He just made pickup sticks out of the trees, really wrecked the area. It was 2 weeks before we had power back. Everybody in my neighborhood had to clean out their freezers before stuff went bad. We all dragged out our stuff. We helped each other cut our driveways clear. The black people, the white people, everybody was pulling together. And 2 weeks later, when the lights went back on and the blue glows came from the living rooms, everybody wandered back in. And if I went back there today, Sebastian, people, we'd talk about that 2 week period. That would be what we would end up talking about. And, it, you know, our life wasn't on the line, but it was the camaraderie and it was the pulling together around a shared sense of purpose. That's our highlight. And I'm wondering, how do we go about creating those highlights without necessarily waiting for an earthquake, a storm, an external forcing function to say, hey, come and engage with each other?
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, you're asking, can we have it all, you know, which is a reasonable thing to want, right? Of course. Can we have it all? Can we have the benefits of a modern affluent society without giving up the benefits of intense communal, sort of intensely communal life? I don't know. That's never been done before. I mean, people act communally because they're forced to by circumstances, and then as soon as they can get away with it, they start acting selfishly, which is also probably an adaptive behavior and deeply wired into us. So how can we do that? I mean, I'm going to be a little flip here and say ban the car. You know, I mean, if we couldn't drive, we would be forced to rely on the people immediately around us, in other words, within walking distance, for all of our life's needs. We work in our own neighborhood. We would form community bonds. That's how we're meant to live. I'm not suggesting we ban the car, but just as a thought experiment, it's kind of an interesting thing to picture. But you know, more broadly, I mean, realistically, we're not going to go back to sort of living in lean-tos and cooking around a campfire. I get that. It's not logistically possible for a modern society to do that, and it's not desirable, obviously. But I think there are things we can do on the sort of macro level. I think one of the things that's affecting people is that not only are the actual communities a bit broken apart by the layout of suburbs, by the car, by all kinds of things, but at the macro level of the country, we've stopped thinking of ourselves as a unity. If you ask people, what do you owe your country? They sort of look at you blankly. And I remember when I was 18 and I had to sign my Selective Service card, which, you know, and boys, not girls, but boys still have to do this. They get a card in the mail when they're 18 from the government saying, we want to know where you live in case we need to draft you. And this was right after Vietnam. And, every adult I knew was against Vietnam. And I was like, what the hell is this? The Selective Service card for the draft? Are you kidding? And I said, I'm not going to sign this. And my father had grown up in Europe. And, you know, he explained that France, where he grew up, was saved. Europe was saved by the United States. But coming ashore, literally wading ashore, or armies wading ashore and sorting things out. And he said, no, you are going to sign that. He said, you don't owe your country nothing. You might owe your country your life. And if it's an immoral war, then it's your moral duty to protest it, not fight it. But you don't know that yet. So what can we do short of, you know, war that binds us together? I think national service, mandatory national service with a military option, so that you can serve your country without caring. You can serve your country in any number of ways, in the Peace Corps or working in the inner city or whatever. I think it would be an amazing experience for young people. It would also bring white, black, rich, poor, north, south, or bring everyone together, which this country is sort of sorely in need of. You know, and finally, I think the rhetoric employed by people in power right now is extremely damaging to our sense of unity. For the first time in my life, I hear politicians, really powerful people, talking with contempt, I mean real contempt and derision, about their own president, about the government. About components of the U.S. populations, their fellow citizens, and talking about these people as if they're actually the enemy. And I know from soldiers, like, you don't talk with contempt about someone inside the wire. You know, you may not like him, you may not agree with him, but boy, he might save your life tomorrow. And you don't talk with contempt about those people, and politicians are doing it right now. And it's not only is it a threat to our democracy, but it's really demoralizing and sends the message that there's actually nothing to belong to. And I think that has a really detrimental psychological effect on everybody.
I would certainly agree with that. And I've been noticing as well that in scanning this and reading about what's really going on with our veterans in particular, you know, a friend of mine is a man named Dr. Jonathan Shea. I'm sure you've run across him. And he talks about the sort of injury that some veterans return with. And I believe this ties into what you're saying, that when you undercut the moral pinnings of our togetherness, the fiber that binds us, that you're actually doing something much more damaging than, you know, you might expect, and scoring a few political points might not make it worth it. But he said that some veterans return with what he termed moral injury, and suggested that we as a nation, we must come welcome home the veterans in a new way, and say something along the lines of his words, what you did was done in our name, at our request. We cannot bear your physical wounds or psychological scars, but we can bear the moral responsibility with you. Your transgressions in war, they are our transgressions too. We confess this together. We seek forgiveness together. And so to speak to what you just mentioned, that this sense of togetherness, that this sense of unity that really I think you find obviously in the unit cohesion, you're talking about at the political level that we're losing our national cohesion. That's a dangerous game to play. But I'm wondering if you could talk about this need to feel like we belong to something that at a moral level has integrity and makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think the public is completely disconnected from everything that keeps it alive and safe. I mean, you have people who are ardent pacifists who are happy to live in towns that are protected by policemen who carry guns. And, I mean, I happen to think the police are a good idea. But, I you know, how do you square your pacifism with, you know, basically hiding behind armed people for your security and protection? You know, there's a rhetorical problem. It's a philosophical problem. I don't know what the answer is, but at least acknowledge the hypocrisy of it. I remember, I mean, I was against the Iraq war, but I didn't think it was about oil. I was against it for other reasons. But I was amazed to see, you know, politically I'm liberal, I'm a Democrat, but I really hate the hypocrisy of the occasional hypocrisy of the left. And I was amazed to see bumper stickers that said no blood for oil on cars. I mean, on machines that run on oil. And these people had no no awareness of the irony. No blood for oil on an SUV that gets 12 miles to the gallon, probably driven by someone who's, calls themselves an environmentalist. And, you know, so the public's disconnected from everything, right? So, of course, it's disconnected from the wars. There are wars. I mean, as Shea and other people have pointed out, the country paid for them, chose them, and in some ways benefit from them. And it's really not the soldiers' wars. They were hired to fight them for us, and we need to, for our own good and for the good of the soldiers, we need to own that stuff.
Well, beyond that, I think we need to assure that the wars are being fought on proper terms. And I'll be let me confess, I studied the Iraq War intensely. I was against it right from the outset, not because I was a no blood for oil guy, but because I read the entire UNESCO report on weapons of mass destruction and came to my own conclusion that it was impossible that Iraq had what was being claimed they had. And now we know that that the Iraq war was founded on deceitful and even blatantly fraudulent intelligence. That must add to, I mean, once you whooped up in patriotic spirit post 9/11 and you go off to fight for your country, that must be especially bitter to discover the true underpinnings of that particular war.
Yeah, I mean, I'm amazed. I mean, I'm very close to a lot of soldiers and soldiers, veterans, for the most part, really like my work, which I'm very honored by. But most of these guys are pretty conservative, right? And I don't hide the fact that I'm liberal. It makes for some interesting conversations. And I'm amazed, increasingly by the year, more and more veterans that I talk to will say something to me like, "I'm a conservative. I just voted for George Bush, but boy, the Iraq war was an incredible mistake. And I really can't forgive that the Bush administration for forcing us into that. And that's a more and more, I mean, real mockery of the Bush administration for that decision. And that, and this, these aren't sort of liberal wing nuts, right? I mean, these are like conservative ex-military guys. And it's really an amazing shift to hear, in their voices.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, anybody who studies it understands that, you know, mistake is a kind way to put it. It was really founded on something that I think is a nation that's a hairball in our throat we haven't coughed up yet. You know, we can't just sort of say, oh, yeah, that was awkward. Let's move on. Because there was something there that we did. We as a culture, whether we went off and fought in it directly, we have the responsibility, the shared responsibility for that. But that idea of national service you talked about, which is about shared responsibility, I think it, from my cat seat, I'm seeing a real lack of shared responsibility in this country. And I do note that countries that have some sort of national service, be it Israel or Switzerland or countries like that, that they do, and they're smaller, more homogenous and have other, different issues. But it seems to be something that really could add a lot to this idea of, okay, maybe we can't get back to the 150 unit tribal function, but at least we would have some larger sense of togetherness in this larger story.
Yeah, I think that I'm absolutely in agreement. I think it would be a tremendously powerful thing, and it would do two things. It would make the country feel like it's engaged in a united activity somehow. It would be a sort of democratizing influence. I mean, meaning it would expose every different category of American to every other category of America. I mean, the great thing about the military is it really is black, white, rich, poor, you know, whatever. It's the whole mix. I mean, you have people who dropped out of Harvard to join the Marines after 9/11, and you have people from a very poor segment of society as well, the whole spectrum. And national service would be, I think, a tremendous experience in that sense as well.
Yeah. Now, you know, I was, I don't really do holidays well when I'm told to do them, all the Hallmark holidays. And I have to confess, you know, the whole idea of Veterans Day, where you get out and you wave a flag and you go, I support the troops, has always been hollow to me. And I want to note here that the fact we do have a volunteer military today, it's the lowest population percentage of any wartime doing the fighting, less than 0.5% if I got my numbers right, which means there's really no general engagement in the fighting by the general populace. In fact, many might think it's just a job someone signed up for. So really no sounding board on any level when you get home from a conflict nowadays, no heroes welcome. I mean, some people of fighting age may not even be aware there's anything going on in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria at this point. I'm wondering how that factors in. And if we were going to learn how other cultures have appropriately honored their warriors home after asking them to do the unthinkable and to take the ultimate sacrifices for us, How would we refashion Veterans Day into something that was more than a day off from work?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, the 1% serve or 0.5%, whatever it is, I mean, it's an important thing to point out, but you have to understand that to change that number, to make it higher, 5% serve or whatever, you wind up with a massive, massive military, which we can't afford. So the question really isn't changing that number. It's changing the relationship between that 1%, that 0.5%, and the rest of the country. What came to me, having looked at some Native American ceremonies, where those cultures brought warriors back from combat, and then veterans back from America's wars, with these communal, these sort of community-wide ceremonies, and they often involved a sort of recounting of when the warrior recounted his exploits on the battlefield, sang them, danced them, reenacted them. And so I had this idea, I mean, we're a de-ritualized society, but suppose maybe we could do that in our own appropriate context. The center of civic life in every town is the city hall. You know, Veterans Day, they're not open for business, and so those buildings can be used. And if you could open them up every Veterans Day, and we've done this, we did this last fall, last Veterans Day in Massachusetts, open them up, turn on the PA system, And a veteran of any war has the right to stand up and speak for 10 minutes about what the war felt like. And there's really no boundaries, right? This isn't an exercise of patriotism. This isn't an anti-war. This is just what did it feel like to fight for this country? Some guys will be extremely angry about the war that they had to fight. Some will be very proud. Some will be crying too hard to talk at all. And when you say, I support the troops, that doesn't really mean anything, right? It doesn't help anybody. But what that would then mean is, that means showing up for a couple of hours at the town hall and just hearing a few of these guys talk, a few of these old veterans talk. And when we did it in Marblehead, Massachusetts last fall, it was incredibly, incredibly powerful. And an amazing variety of people, including an older woman who stood up and said, she said, I fought in Vietnam as a guy, and I came home and got a sex change. And, boy, did that rock people, that we're not expecting that. And it was quite transformative.
I would completely support the idea of giving that public airing, because it means that we're actually listening to the experiences. And I've done some inquiry into looking into how Alcoholics Anonymous does what it does. And lo and behold, it turns out that there is something deeply cathartic, very human, about being in a group of people and being able to share your story, no matter how painful or shameful it might be. And that's wired into us, that this idea that we can have this togetherness. And it's interesting to talk to people who've been through AA, many of them describing that they know people who they only know by first name in that room better than they know their own family. And so what you're really talking about is something I think Brené Brown has been talking on in her work, is that we need greater openness, greater vulnerability, greater ability to share at the deeper levels, and that there's something in being in closer approximation with each other that's part of it. And the rest of it is that we get to share more intimately with each other life, and that's something we're actually wired for, and something that, for better or worse, is recreated in the unit experience in a wartime situation. But there are other ways that people can consciously create that if they want to.
That's right. And, again, we evolved to live in small groups in a dangerous environment, and those are the bodies and minds that we're lugging around with us, and we're never going to escape that. I mean, however, you can have an iPhone, you can you can enjoy air conditioning, whatever.
Yeah.
You're never going to escape that heritage that we have, and it's a wonderful heritage that got us here, and it shouldn't be disavowed. And there's basic human needs of contact and connection, starting from infancy. The carrying rates, the skin-on-skin contact rates for human infants is incredibly low compared to other primates. I mean, in modern society, compared to traditional societies and other primates, and it's not good. It's not what infants need. But we live in a complex world where people need to work and away from the home. And what are you going to do? But it has consequences.
Well, I'll tell you, Sebastian, this really caught me off guard, and I still have it on the top of my desk here. It was a Wall Street Journal article in their living section, and it was all about how you can get your baby to sleep through the night as early as 2 months, and they put on a pediatrician and some other experts, and really they were coaching people to just let the kid cry it out as early as possible. Nowhere in there did they suggest the idea that infants cry for a reason other than they're trying to manipulate you. They're crying because they have a need that's unmet. And what was, at any rate, this is just, I consider to be an atrocious piece of advice. And what was funny about it, ironic to me, is that the companion article that shared the side slot on that same page of the newspaper was how to recover your ability to be more empathetic as an adult. I thought that was just a wonderful, ironic juxtaposition.
That's right. That's great. Yeah, no, that really says it all. All this affluence has given us this wonderful independence, then we put a huge amount of energy in figuring out how to reconnect again. Infants cry because they're in danger when they're alone. I mean, primates that are alone in the jungle are in danger. They are a carnivore, a predator's meal immediately. And so, human primates are wired with that. Human babies are wired with that knowledge, and they don't like being put in a room by themselves at all, because they know that their life's in danger.
So, Sebastian, what's next for you? What's got your eye now?
I'm just doing this book tour for Tribe, and after that, I don't know. Hopefully, a more communal existence somewhere in the world. Hopefully, I grow I grew up in a suburb, and I've been looking for that my whole life. So, yeah, we'll see.
All right. Well, I certainly hope you find that. Thank you for your time. The book is Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. It's available everywhere. You should read it. And we've been talking with Sebastian Younger. Sebastian, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.